So what's new with anybody?
ABCD is starting to ramp up in a very scary and fast way.
No.
Not that I'm complaining.
Oh, don't complain. But
Sarah's here.
Hi, Sarah. Oh, I'm just looking for something on my computer. I can never find anything. Oh, so anything new and exciting with anybody?
I'm at RO1 going in today. This is Scott.
Scott?
Yeah.
So do we. That's right. We have a grant going in tomorrow. Or today.
Good luck to everybody.
Yeah.
Yes.
I haven't had much recently other than ABCD, but...
Scott, you converted to an R99, right? Or whatever it is, an RO?
No, yes, I did. About.
So the budgets on those are 250, but it includes indirect.
Yes, it is 250, and that is the total.
Total.
At least it was when I did mine a couple years ago.
And did UNC have to offer you a tenure track line?
That is not clear if it's required. It's especially difficult because UNC doesn't always distinguish necessarily. It's kind
it
of a great.
It also depends on your program officer. I mean, we had someone convert, Yaling Zhang converted to her ROO from UCLA, now here at USC, and it was a huge process. Tenure track, she ended up startup, everything. And,
yeah.
I know other people who it's like, yeah, you can stay and you get nothing and like it, and, you know, so.
Yeah.
Well, I had Fulton Cruz helped, you know, he gave me, you know, obviously I had space and, you know, startup money and all that stuff that he gave me, and he just, you know, put that all in a letter, you know, saying that, showing his support, and of course
really,
being.
Did he really,
I'm sorry?
Did he really give you the money?
Yeah. he did.
All right. Scott, I may call you about it later. All right.
Yeah, sure.
Or I might call you too, since you both been through it, and we have to go through it now.
Yeah,
all
I'm
right.
Happy to.
Michael Charnas.
I'm here.
All right. Jennifer.
I'm here.
Ken Jones.
I'm here.
Hey, Ken. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Ed?
I'm good.
That's Arizona. Good.
Tina there?
She's in the process of getting here. She's close.
Tatiana? Leah? Peter
I'm Hannah? Here. I'm here, Leah.
Hey, long time no talk. Peter Hammond?
Yes, I'm here.
Rohan?
Yeah.
Hey. Kirstie Donald? Tom Donaldson, Kathy?
Ed, hi, it's Tom.
Hey, Tom. John Hannigan's going to be late. Sarah Jo?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. But I thought I heard your voice.
Yes, melodious.
Dan? Dale?
I'm
Dale.
Here. Still here as well.
Okay. All righty.
And this is Bill Barnett. I'm here, too.
Oh, hi, Bill. I thought, yeah, all righty. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Jeff. Jeff is here as well. I stuck away from my site visit.
Okay, good. Hey, Jeff. All right, so a few things. The first one, Kathy's not on the call, Kathy Sulik, and that's because she's on her way to Washington, D.C., to present the Keller lectureship. And so it's a really big honor. Mark Keller you know, was a biggie in the alcohol field, and they have a lecture series for him at NIAAA, and you give these talks in the gigantic auditorium at NIH, and I mean, past recipients, Fulton Cruz has gotten it, Coob's gotten it, Adrian Harris, Ken Kemmler, E. Sullivan. So it's a rather prestigious lecture that she's giving. And so I wanted everybody here to know that, to acknowledge that fact that she's done that.
Well, that's fabulous.
Yeah. And I wanted to discuss the March face-to-face meeting. If it's still okay with NIAAA, we plan on meeting in Austin, Texas. We got bids for the Hilton that we normally stay in, but the rates have gone up significantly, or they're high for that week anyway. And therefore, if there are no objections, we'd like to just go ahead and continue planning the meeting for Austin, Texas. Any objections?
Good to know it.
NIAAA is all right?
Yep.
Bill will do that and send out all the necessary things for you to reserve your rooms at the ATT Center. Johan, the one issue is we can meet in the ATT Center and have to pay for the room there, or we can meet in Johan's department and not have to pay for the room. How far away are they?
It's a short walk across campus, and the campus is beautiful, so So the ATT Center is actually on campus itself. It's just on the opposite side. So it's a short walk.
Okay. So we'll decide about that. We have to see about catering. So that'll make our choice. Okay. The publication policy since the last conference call, Bill? Any updates on that, or? All right. Guess there's nothing there.
Did you say Jill or Bill?
Bill. You have it on the last time on this. There hasn't been any activity, I guess, on publication since the last conference. So I'm assuming that people are publishing, and if they are, to please get that information in, I guess, Jennifer. And the CFAS for RSA and ISPRA, Michael, I know you're working on that. If you and Peter can stay on at the end, we can discuss it a little bit more, but you want to give us an update on possibilities and ideas for those two meetings?
Yes. So I've heard from a lot of people, and I've sort of lumped the ideas into two categories. To try to differentiate enough for two different meetings. We had talked about including an informatics and how to access CFAS data on both. We could do one or the other, but I think it is timely to talk about how to make the data available, and we can collectively decide how to do that. One of the ideas and this is still in Kuwait, so bear with me, is related to environmental or experiential influences on the development of FASD. And ideas that came in under those categories included Johan's and L-leucine. That's a little tangential, but I just put it in there. Scott Parnell and Kathy Fuller, the synergistic effect of cannabis exposure or cannabinoids on FASD. Elizabeth's idea about looking at SES and effects on brain imaging in the FASD population. And then Sarah had said that she might be able to do something like that, looking at neurocognition, although not the tools as sophisticated as people who do study SDS usually do. And so if we include informatics in that, that would leave three of the four, and there may be others that people also nominate that follow roughly that theme, other things that impact alcohol's effect on development, broadly speaking. This one would probably be for RSA, because all the people that I've named are American, and it have international representation. So for the ISRA one, I was sort of working on early effects or early recognition as a potential theme. We had Christy's work looking at South Africa, Julie Cable's work on the cardiac effects, the cardiac reflex. Tina Chambers had suggested some ideas related to early identification using microRNAs. We can throw into that also ideas on early effects and their long-term consequences, which could encompass metabolic effects, inflammatory effects, and so on. So those are really early ideas. We need three. I mentioned more than three to go along with a data presentation if we were to have one. And, if people have ideas that either modify or sharpen what they had in mind to fit either of those two themes or have suggestions for other themes that would incorporate some of the projects that I described, please send them my way. I'll try to put this together next week and then ask for people to submit abstracts again by the end of the month. The deadline, I believe it's RSA and November 30th for ISBRA. Peter Hammond and Ed and I will talk about what Peter and his group are able to do. But we do need at least one international, and my Canadian roots are not going to do it.
Okay. Yeah, I think there's some possibilities there, and I and Peter can talk about them at the end, because there's Allison Noble, a possibility. So, all right. Jill handed me a note about this publication policy that people should fill out the Google Forms for their concept proposal, manuscript submission, and then whether or not the article is accepted. So please don't forget to do that for your papers. And, all right, so Elizabeth, I believe you are going to give us a little WebEx today.
Yes, it's going to be pieced together, but I will start very briefly. So should I select it, Jill? Share screen or?
Yes, now under the quick start select your desktop.
I need my power. Okay, so you can see my screen? Everyone? Yeah?
Yep.
Okay, so following on Peter's, I'm going to talk just for, 3 minutes about the work we're doing with PATH. And Jeff is going to talk about some connectivity stuff that he just sent me yesterday, but I think it's important for you to see. And then Christina and I are going to talk about some of her hormone stuff. So it'll be little pieces. And I know Jeff has a meeting to get to, so I don't want a lot of questions until the end, if that's possible. So we're submitting a revision of this proposal to do brain imaging in the past. South Africa cohort. We're going to submit it tomorrow. And the reason I wanted to bring it up is because Peter was talking last week about his work with the face and Mike's with face brain, And I just thought, you know, even if this grant is not funded, we do have brain data on 70 kids who are aged, you know, 6, 7, and 8. So our proposal will include face and brain and neurocognition. And, you know, the main, one of the main points of it is to look at environmental factors that impact development. And another one is to try to really look at the whole range of drinking behavior. And so this is just telling you the pilot data that I'll show you. We had initially we had 39, but I just wanted to show you a little histogram of the women who reported drinking starting in trimester 2, because not everyone started in trimester 1. I just wanted to show you the range of drinks per day during the second trimester. So 6 women said between 0 and 1. A lot of them said, you know, between 2 and 3, and we even have as many as 12 to 13, 14, and 15. So we have quite a range from pretty low to very high in the sample that we have brains on. And this is for the overall sample. Christina, can you explain this one?
So this is just looking at, we have our total number of participants up here. So for first trimester, this is the total number of individuals available through the PATH cohort in South Africa. So there's 2,897 that said yes, they did consume alcohol during the first trimester, and this is the average standard drink per drinking day. So you can see the range. There's some that are reporting 1 all the way up to about 10, just within 1 standard deviation. And then second trimester, you know, we still have above 2,000 women who are saying they did drink. And then third trimester, women actually came at 2 different points, which is really great for looking at quantity, frequency, timing. But so you can see there's quite a large range of alcohol consumption at all of these trimesters.
And this was one of the reviewers' concerns from our initial submission, that we wouldn't have enough people with low. So these are just some preliminary data when we had a smaller group, and this shows, the graphs show the correlations between drinks per week during the third trimester in various brain regions. So again, these are small samples. We're going to rerun them with the 70 subjects to see if they hold up. And then, you know, we're interested in the hippocampus, some of Christina's, Yuvin's early work in animal models, and we see correlations between the hippocampus and drinks per day during the third trimester among moms who were still drinking during the third trimester. So I won't go into great detail, but I just wanted you to know that we probably have to work with tests. We want to do this thing with the brain and combine it with the face from when they were 1 year older or older. Okay, so, yeah, that was what I was just saying. So, Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You want, Jill, I think you could share the screen with him and then pop it back to me when Jeff's done.
Okay, so I have my PowerPoint up. Can you see this yet?
Just under the Quick Start tab, hit Share Screen.
Okay. Okay. Seeing that yet?
Yep, we're seeing it here in Washington.
All right, anybody not seeing it? Okay. So I just thought I would run through the a little bit on the connectivity analyses. And before I start with the data, I will just give you a little bit of an overview of what we're talking about, just to make sure that we're all on the same page about this connectivity. Can you see the slide right now? My screen's looking a little funny. Can you see the slide that says brief overview of functional connectivity?
Yes.
Perfect. So, again, what we're talking about with these analyses are not task-based fMRI, but instead resting state fMRI. And the advantage of these kinds of tasks, or these kind of procedures, are that we are working with kids who may or may not be able to do tasks, and this is giving us a global measure of their brain network status rather than their ability to perform on a task or their individual brain response to a task. So the idea is to really look at network status or network integrity. We think that there are plenty of studies out now using this methodology that show relationships with cognition and clinical variables, and that is obviously what we want to do with this data in CFAST. And we know that the network backbone, the white matter, is abnormal in FASD because of DTI studies. So this method is really well suited to pediatric populations. Practically speaking, what the child does is lie on the scanner for 6 minutes, and it's a fairly reliable set of techniques. Having said that, I will say that I have been wrestling with this data, and it has some challenges when we're working with data across multiple sites, and we're working with data that is to some extent sensitive to movement and individual differences, and it is proving to be not perfect data, surprisingly. Here's the basic methodology. We take the brain and we parcelate it into a bunch of regions, in this case 62. We're extracting the fMRI time series over that 6 minutes that I mentioned for each one of these regions. So each one of these color-coded regions that you see on the brains in the upper part of the panel, we're extracting the fMRI signal from all of the voxels in those regions and then averaging it across each of those regions. And then we run graph theory analyses on these measures. And I've talked about this previously at the last CFAST meeting, but just to briefly reiterate, if you look at the lower right-hand corner of your screen where you have three basic network types, you have what they're calling an ordered network, a small world network, and a random network. And if you look at the two extremes, an ordered network has a lot of connectivity at the local level. Each dots that are nearby each other are connected with regularity. If you look at the extreme example on the right where you have a random network, there you have a lot of scatter in terms of the way the brain regions are connected. The one in the middle is a small world network, and essentially what this is you have a fair amount of high connectivity locally, but then you also have a few paths that run the length of the system and that allow you to theoretically get information from one place to another with an efficient path. And so this is kind of how we think the brain is structured, that there is a lot of connectivity at the level of cortex, gray matter, but that the white matter serves to make these long-distance connections, and it does it with high speed. We can use this methodology to extract network measures, things like path lengths. So in other words, what is the smallest number of connections that need to be made in order for two regions to be connected? And we think that if something has a higher path length or longer path length, that means that it's less efficient. We can look at clustering, so how at the local level, how connected are these local regions to each other? Are they densely connected or are they more thinly connected? And then we can look at these efficiency measures, which are basically derivatives of those measures. So it's in looking at networks, there is always a trade-off, and you can have dense connectivity at the local level, with some strategic long-distance connections, or you can have a low level of local clustering and lots of short path lengths. Ideally, we think that the brain is a small world network, or in some ways is a small world network. And so we think that it is organized so that there's a lot of dense local connectivity, but there are efficient paths for information to get long distances as well. And that's what we're measuring here. So I'm just showing you data that we first collected a couple of years back in which, if you look at the table, we were seeing these abnormalities in kids with FASD versus controls in things like the path length, the clustering coefficient, and the efficiency measures. And they were small differences, 1 to 3%, but these were significant effects. In this case, we were seeing longer path lengths. And more local clustering, which we're going to see again in the CFAS data here in just a minute. This is some of the data that I showed you back in April, and these were kind of preliminary data that we were looking at in which we were seeing the same kinds of thing in the CFAS data. Longer path lengths, again, differences of about 3%, to 1 to 3%, and again, we were seeing differences in the local efficiency, so more clustering at the local level in kids who have FAS. If you look at the figures on the bottom, you can see one of the problems with this data in that there is a lot of variability when we pull this data together across kids and across sites. So this is one of the challenges, is having data that is pretty highly variable. One of the things that I've discovered in looking at this data recently is that it turns out to be fairly important to adjust for age. And so I've started to do this now in all of the analyses going forward, that removes some of the variability because there are developmental patterns in how these connectivity measures change. So this, what we're looking at now, is data from all four sites, 133 combined subjects with FASD and controls. And this is what we have for subjects who have good resting state fMRI data from time one across all four sites. We do lose some subjects who move too much in the scanner, and that these methods are sensitive to that. I don't know the exact number offhand. I could pull that up if somebody wants to know that. But we're not losing half of the data. We may be losing, I'm guessing, something like 25 to 30 subjects, and we're ending up with this 133. So what this is showing us is that the kids who have FAS on the left side are demonstrating the highest clustering, and higher than those who are non-FASD, and also higher than those who are falling in the deferred category, according to Ken. One of the other challenges you see here is that the N is small for the kids with full FAS. So we have 13 kids who have good resting state fMRI data who we were able to scan. Here's another one of these metrics. Now, this time we're looking at local efficiency. So this is basically, again, related to how locally connected these brain networks are. We're seeing the same pattern here. You'll notice that the variability is down substantially when we control for age in these kids. So this is an improvement in the way we were doing these analyses before. Same basic pattern, though. FAS different than non-FAS. A slight difference from the deferred, but not a significant difference there. This one is a little bit harder to understand, and I have not figured out how to interpret this yet. So here we're looking at path lengths. And here we're actually not seeing differences between the FAS group and the non-FAS group, but we are seeing substantially shorter path lengths in the kids who are in the deferred category. And I've been looking at this many different ways to try to see if there's some confounding factors here that are causing this, but I don't have an explanation for why the kids in the deferred category would be so different on this measure than the other two groups, especially when the other two groups don't differ from each other. So the data from the four sites so far seems to be showing, I would say, abnormalities in the local clustering pattern and the local efficiency, especially in the FAS kids, although we have a caveat that this is really a small number of kids. We haven't seen differences in global efficiency like we saw in some of our previous local data here from Minnesota. We haven't seen that across the sites. And we're seeing these unusual kind of things with the deferred group, and so especially with the path lengths. Interestingly, the one measure that seems to really distinguish these network variables has to do with the palpebral fissure lengths. So there may be that's the one characteristic that seems most correlated and most discriminating among the network measures. I just started to look a few days ago briefly at how these deferred kids really differ from the non-FAS group. And so far, they differ in ways that you might expect. the deferred kids have smaller heads than the non-FAS kids. They have smaller palpebral fissures. They're more likely to have smooth philtrum and thin vermilion. So they are differing in ways that we might expect. I need to look at the ADHD status next, and I'm having to pull that data out and try to find out whether or not there's some differences. It looks like there may be some differences in the way that those two groups look. This is just showing you what I was telling you about palpebral fissures. Here we're looking at local efficiency. The kids who have palpebral fissure widths that are narrow, less than 10th percentile, are abnormal on this clustering coefficient compared to the kids who do not. That's the major difference. So I think we have so far limited conclusions because of the relatively small number of kids that we have with FAS and the fact that there are a fair number of kids in this deferred category. But the findings are fairly clear that we're seeing abnormalities in these local efficiency and local clustering measures. My interest is really to see whether we can use some of these measures to help us with this deferred category and to try to, for example, parse out some of the kids in the deferred category to see who do they look more like, the FAS or the non-FAS on an individual level. And the next steps are to really start to combine the cognitive data with these data. We have previously seen some associations with spatial functioning. I would expect that we might see associations with processing speed types of measures, and that is kind of what we're working on next.
Okay, Jill, can you pass it back to me?
Elizabeth, can I make a, this is Ken, and I know
yeah.
Jeff's got to leave. Can I ask a question or make an observation?
Yeah.
All right, Jeff, you know, the deferred category is a mush. In other words,
yeah.
You can be deferred for many different reasons on the physical exam. And I'm wondering if you pulled the deferred category out and looked at it based upon and tried to put people in the deferred category in sort of different subcategories. It might help you. Do you understand
yes.
what I'm saying?
Yes, and that is kind of where I got onto looking at whether, you know, which distinguishing characteristics there are among them. And so I started to do that, just looking at the deferred category to see if they fall into different groupings.
Yes, that's what.
Yeah. I mean, if you have suggestions about how you think it might be useful to parse them, I can parse them on the network measures and then look at their characteristics, but if you have other suggestions, let me know.
I will.
Okay.
Jeff, one other question. This is Dan. Have you looked at correlations with the DTI data?
No, that we have not done that yet.
Okay. So that's the next little bit of data is going to be with DTI data from both Minnesota and LA. So it's multi-site from CFAS 3. And literally, Jeff and I just sort of coordinated on this morning, so we haven't talked about commonalities between the network stuff and the white matter, but this will give us food for thought. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Hi, this is Christina Euben. So I'm going to be talking about a manuscript that we have ready for internal review right now, so this is really good timing, but it's looking using DTI data from CFAS participants at both University of Minnesota and here at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and these kids actually gave us a passive drool salivary sample, and we looked at gonadal hormones in these kids. So animal research has shown over and over again that there are sex differences in the way that prenatal alcohol exposure impacts the brain. And so that has prompted many years of research looking at how are gonadal hormones possibly dysregulated following prenatal alcohol exposure to explain why alcohol does different things to the male versus female brain. So these are all just from the rodent models. I'm not going to go through them in great detail, but basically you see suppressed testosterone levels. And in females, you see a range of alterations because, of course, the female endocrine system is very complex across the estrus cycle. And then in humans, we really haven't begun to fully explore how there may be sex differences in the impact of prenatal alcohol exposure or how kids with FASD, how their endocrine systems may be altered. The Jacobsons did publish a study last year, and this was adolescents that were 14 years old, and they actually found increased testosterone and that there was a dose-dependent effect on testosterone levels. So the increase in testosterone is different than what animal studies have found, but animal studies really have looked at the early postnatal period and the early adulthood period. So this is interesting that the Jacobsons did look at adolescents. But really, it's an area that there's a huge gap in knowledge. So we were interested in, do the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure on structural connectivity, specifically DTI measures, differ between boys and girls? Or are we seeing parallel effects? Does prenatal alcohol exposure do the same thing to the male and female brain? And second, if we are seeing sex differences, are they related possibly to endocrine dysregulation? So our sample size, you can see here, it was very controlled. So we wanted to make sure to really do a good job at looking at sex differences to perfectly...
Hello?
Hello.
Did we lose her?
I think so. Sounds like it.
I lost you. Oh.
She may not know she's off.
Well,
I know. You can send a chat. Yeah. Well, while we're waiting, Jeff, are you still on?
Bill, can you send her a chat?
Yeah.
I'm going to fill some time. Jeff, I have a quick question. And I'm sorry if I missed this in your presentation. Was that only alcohol-exposed subjects?
No. They were FAS, non-FAS, and deferred, and that was everyone included. Now I have...
Included. So have you looked at the exposure by diagnosis?
I have looked at using the DEM group class variable to look at alcohol exposed versus non-alcohol exposed and have not seen differences between those two groups. So it seems to be the kids who have some of the physical stigmata compared to the ones who do not, that kind of shows some distinctions in these network measures. So far, I haven't seen anything when looking just alcohol.
I'm so sorry. Somehow we got cut off.
Okay, Jeff, we can talk later.
Okay,
Christina's going to continue. Sorry.
Okay. Not entirely sure where it stopped, but we basically did a frequency matching to make sure that males and females and control and individuals with prenatal alcohol exposure, we had the same age range and the same means to really look at sex differences in a meaningful way. And we also did something that is standard in other imaging modality practices, which is looking at motion and controlling for it, whereas with diffusion tensor imaging, there really isn't a current standard, and a lot of people don't necessarily explore motion or rule out based on motion or do it in a best practice way across the field. So that's something that we did here. We actually removed individuals with high levels of motion and made sure that there were no group differences based on motion as well. Okay. So the gonadal hormones that we looked at are highlighted here in the circles. We had progesterone, DHEA, which is, of course, a precursor to both testosterone and estradiol. And the progesterone and estradiol were actually only explored in girls, whereas DHEA and testosterone were in males and females. And I can talk more about methodology around collection and time of day and how we dealt with that if anyone's interested. So this is just looking at how does prenatal alcohol exposure impact fractional anisotropy, or FA, and then mean diffusivity, or MD, in the brain using TBSS, which is tract-based spatial statistics, which is a standard in the field. And so this is just trying to replicate what has been shown before in the field. But what's interesting is with this tight age range and controlling for motion, we actually found increased FA in several of our regions of interest in the boys. And we also found, we typically see increased FA with increased age, and we saw this very large effect in our control boys, but we did not see this in boys with alcohol exposure. And then in girls, we saw the typical pattern, which is reduced FA compared to control. When you look at mean diffusivity, we only saw effects in boys, and this, again, is kind of in the opposite pattern of what is typically found in the field. We saw decreased mean diffusivity in alcohol exposed versus controls, and again, when you look at interaction with age, we see mean diffusivity go down with age, which we saw in controls, and again, this was lost in our alcohol exposed kids. Now, looking at how does this relate to endocrine hormone levels, we didn't see any huge significant differences in testosterone levels up here on the upper left or DHEA in either boys or girls. But when you look at the ratio of testosterone to DHEA, we saw this interesting increase with across age in alcohol-exposed kids, but not in controls. And then in girls, we did not see any effect of prenatal alcohol exposure on estradiol or progesterone. Again, it's a small sample, and there's a lot of limitations. So I would not conclude that there is not endocrine dysregulation in this sample. But so looking at how does this relate to brain? So this, again, is just in boys in those regions of interest that saw significant effect of prenatal alcohol exposure. And looking at how it relates to testosterone, and again, we see these increased FAs related to increased levels of testosterone in multiple of the regions of interest. You can see across these four graphs in control. However, in boys with alcohol exposure, this relationship is lost with the exception of the superior longitudinal fasciculus, but it is a reduced effect size. What's really interesting is we see the same pattern in a lot of the same regions, only this time the cortical spinal tract is also included, again, in boys, in how FA levels relate to DHEA levels. And this pattern is lost following prenatal alcohol exposure, but you see a clear pattern in control boys. We also see DHEA relating to mean diffusivity in both control and alcohol exposed boys, but to a much greater effect size in control boys. So this is just the significant ROIs that were related to gonadal hormone dysregulation in boys, and I just highlighted them here so that you can see it really is across the entire brain. There's not one part of the brain that seems to be more impacted. So again, just a quick summary. We saw a different pattern when you look at FA and MD results in males. There might be some methodological differences from past studies. And we saw reduced FA in females, which is typically observed in the field, and this did seem to be related to hormone levels in control males, but not alpha-exposed males, and this association with this developmental pattern of increased FA or decreased MD across age was lost in alpha-exposed males. So, and I'm happy to talk more about specific regions of interest as well, but that's about all. Thank you.
Hey, Jeff, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, so with your findings so far, how would you expect that to relate to FA? So I would expect higher or less organized systems to have lower FA than more organized systems.
Right, and that's what we've seen in the one study that we published previously where we found regions where there was abnormal DTI findings in the colostrum, and then we found that the connectivity between regions was abnormal, that right and left. Now, we haven't necessarily done this at the whole brain level, so I don't know for sure whether we're going to see relationships between whole brain functional connectivity, which is what we're looking at with these measures, and specific white matter regions. We might have to look more broadly at white matter to get some kind of an index to compare with the whole brain functional connectivity.
Any other questions? Any other questions? Okay. Well, it looks like you're making progress, and and collaborating on this type of work, and I think that's all great for the renewal process. And good luck with these publications. It's kind of, I'm trying to figure it out, and I'll have to wrap my head around this a little bit more. But there's obviously something going on. And, so just have to wait, I guess, until we get more subjects for Jeff's work. But the hormone stuff is interesting. Too bad Joanne's not on. Too bad Joanne's not on to...
I've spoken with Joanne last week, and we were just saying how if we need understanding exactly how prenatal alcohol exposure impacts the brain is essential for effective intervention, then, and if sex matters, then we really need to understand these sex differences more to have better interventions. And the other thing is that there are a host of endocrine dysregulation disorders that have all these endocrine treatments right now that currently exist. And if we suspect that endocrine dysregulation is part of FASD, perhaps that's a new avenue for treatment.
It's interesting. It's going to take a while for me to figure or wrap my head around it, though, to figure it out. So I may ask you to send me slides so I can look at them more closely.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're actually in a Dropbox already, and Jill can upload them for you.
Great.
I put them there in case we couldn't get WebEx to work, but... So, Jill, feel free to give it to Ed.
Thanks. I just wanted, is there any other questions or comments? I know that everyone has grants due tomorrow, so we will. I just want to mention that I wanted to thank you all for sending in your comments and paragraphs about meeting your specific aims, where we are in terms of those aims. I want to thank the Science Advisory Board for looking at those. We're putting those together now, and we'll send out anonymous comments that we receive back on these to you in the very near future. And so you can see what you might need to do prior to the resubmission of CFAS to make it more, to put in a better application. To make sure that all the goals that you said you were going to meet, or most of them anyway, were met. And so they're just some comments, but they'll go out to you. I don't want you to think what you did was for naught. So we have them all back, and we will be sending those out. All right? I think rather than go through the individual projects, unless someone has some really startling new findings to talk about, we'll just kind of end it here. And again, if Michael and Peter can stay on, that would be great. Any other comments? Dale, Bill?
Nothing here.
Dan, John, or?
No, not at the moment.
No, not now. Thank you.
Okie dokie. All right, then. Everyone take care, and we'll chat this month. And, I was on the Australian equivalent of 60 Minutes last week, and got very good feedback about what's happening in Australia as a result of this show. So just I'll put that in.
How do we find it?
I was there for 4 hours, and I'm on the TV show for 5 minutes.
Online, Ed? Can we find it online?
You know, it's globally blocked. It's only available in the UK and Australia. I don't know why they do it. It's ABC News, but it's a weird thing. So, all right. I'm sorry. Unless there's anything else, Michael and Peter?
I'm still on.
Yeah,
all right. So, Ed, did they ask you, what did you know and when did you know it?
Exactly. 4 hours. They knew almost nothing, but it came out pretty well.
That's good.
Good.
All right, everybody. Take care and have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.